How Eve Are, a book by Emma Jor Donald Keohthe Flying Saucer Conspiracy, commanded her attention. She took it home to read it at a single sitting. Bearney, although his viewpoint had softened since he talked with the Air Force 13 ace, declined to read it. The lingering resistance ESCRI bred to his continued desire to avoid the painfulness of, to their own starite LING experience, that there had to, 28, the shock be bad encountered. He was not, B insists, trying to be arbitrary or stubborn. / Major Kehoe's thesis in the book, Betty discovered, indicated that the Air Force was making a serious effort to discredit all UFO sightings, at the expense of open scientific inquiry. A former Annapolis graduate and Marine Corps major, Kehoe was instrumental in establishing an organization known as the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena in Washington to correlate and analyze every available UFO sighting in an attempt to find a solution to the mystery, and to prepare the public, if necessary, for the possibility that the objects may be extraterrestrial spacecraft of unknown origin. NICAP, as Major Kehoe's organization has come to be known, arrived at the conclusion that there are basically only two explanations for the consistent, worldwide reporting of UFOs every year: one, widespread and presently unaccountable delusion on a scale so vast that it should be, II, in itself, a matter of urgent scientific study; two, people are seeing maneuvering, apparently controlled objects in the atmosphere. Members of NICAP, many of whom are reputable scientists, professors, technicians, pilots and former high-ranking military officers, argue that the second hypothesis is the more reasonable, and that it is grounded on empirical observations. In its carefully documented study UFO Evidence, the organization analyzes 575 technical and other reliable reports from 46 states, Puerto Rico, Mexico, Canada, and other countries throughout the world. NICAP investigators, serving on a voluntary basis, are instructed to document each case in painstaking detail and to contest wherever possible any wild and irresponsible reports of sightings from the lunatic fringe that has so frequently seized on the subject for either self-aggrandizement or profit. Among the members of NICAP's Board of Governors are Dr. Charles P. Olivier, Professor Emeritus of Astronomy, University of Pennsylvania and President of the American Meteor Society, J. B. Hartranft, Jr., President of the Aircraft Owners and Pilot Association and former Lieutenant Colonel in the Army Air Corps, Dewey Fornit, former Major, U.S. Air Force in charge of the UFO investigation known as Project Blue Book, Professor Charles A. Manny, Head of the Department of Physics, Defiance College, Ohio, and others. On reading Major Kehoe's book, Betty gained more confidence in her own experience. She lost little time in sitting down to write him a letter, 29, Portsmouth, NH, September 26, 1961. Dear Major Kehoe, written any more books about unidentified flying objects since the flying the purpose of this letter is twofold. We wish to inquire if you have. Saucer Conspiracy was published. If so, it would certainly be appreciated full in finding any information more up to date than this book. A stamped, self-addressed envelope is being included for your convenience. If you would send us the name of the publisher, as we have been unsuccessful, my husband and I have become immensely interested in this topic, as we recently had quite a frightening experience, which does seem to differ from others of which we are aware. About midnight on September 20th, the choice of midnight could be either the 19th or the 20th, Betty Hill chose the latter. We were driving in a national forest area in the White Mountains. In NH, this is a desolate, uninhabited area. At first we noticed a bright object in the sky which seemed to be moving rapidly. We stopped our car and got out to observe it more closely with our binoculars. Suddenly it reversed its flight from the north to the southwest and appeared to be flying in a very erratic pattern. As we continued driving and then stopping to watch it, we observed the following flight pattern. The object was spinning and appeared to be lighted only on one side, which gave it a twinkling effect. As it approached our car, we stopped again. As it hovered in the air, in front of us, it appeared to be pancake in shape, ringed with windows in the front through which we could see bright blue-white lights. Suddenly, two red lights appeared on each side. By this time my husband was standing in the road, watching closely. He saw wings protrude on each side and the red lights were on the wing tips. As it glided closer he was able to see inside this object, but not to see El Ozeli. He did see several figures scurrying about as though they were making some hurried type of preparation. One figure was observing us from the windows. From the distance, this was seen, the figures appeared to be about the size of a pencil, held at arm's length, and seemed to be dressed in some type of shiny black uniform. At this point, my husband became shocked and got back in the car, in a hysterical condition, laughing and repeating that they were going to capture us. He started driving the car. The motor had been left running. As we started to move, we heard several buzzing or beeping sounds which seemed to be striking the T-runk of our car. The about 30 miles further south we were again bombarded by those same beeping sounds. The next day we did make a report to an Air Force officer, who seemed he very interested in ONGS and read LIGHTS. We did not report my husband's observation of the interior as it seems too fantastic to be true. A-T-T-H-I-S-T-M-E we arcing for any C-L-U-E that M-I-G-H-T-B-H-L-F-U-L-T-O-M-I, we did not observe this object leaving, but we did not seconds it again, Al:W, husband, in recalling whatever it was he saw that caused him to panic. His mind has completely blacked out at this point. Every attempt to recall leaves him very frightened. This flying object was at least as large as a 4-motor plane. Its flight was noiseless and the lighting of the interior did not reflect on the ground. There does not appear to be any damage to our car from the beeping sounds. We both have been quite frightened by this experience, but fascinated. We feel a compelling urge to return to the spot where this occurred in the hope that we may again come in contact with this object. We realize this regarding developments in the last 6 years. Possibility is slight and we should, however, have more recent information. Any suggested reading would be greatly appreciated. Your book has been of great help to us and a reassurance that we are not the only ones to have undergone an interesting and informative experience. Very truly yours, ISF Mrs. Barney Hill, Mrs. Barney Hill. As Betty Hill's confidence increased through her study of the NICAP material, so did her willingness to reveal more of the details. For the first time in this letter she was willing to talk about Barney's description of the figures within the craft, although she did so with Barney's extremely reluctant approval. Betty's capacity for ventilating her feelings about the incident was helpful. Barney found himself envying her ability to do so, aware that suppressing the facts in his mind could be damaging. Some 10 days after the sighting, Betty began having a series of vivid dreams. They continued for 5 successive nights. Never in her memory had she recalled dreams of such detail and intensity. They dominated her waking life during that week and continued to plague her afterward. But they stopped abruptly after 5 days, and never returned again. In a sense, they assumed the proportion of nightmares. They were so awesome and of such magnitude that she hesitated to mention them to Barney, who was working those 5 nights and not with her when the dreams took place. When she eventually did mention rather casually that she was having a series of nightmares, Barney was sympathetic but not too concerned, and the matter was dropped. Betty did not press the matter further. A few weeks later, another puzzling incident occurred that neither Barney nor Betty could explain. They were driving in the car through the countryside near Portsmouth, on a road in a sparsely populated area. Up ahead of them a parked car was partially blocking the road. A group, 31, of people were standing outside the car, and Barney began to slow down gradually to avoid an accident. Suddenly Betty was overcome by fear. She could not explain it, even to herself. "Barney," she said. "Barney, keep going. Please don't slow down. Keep going, keep going. and she found herself starting to open the car door on the passenger side, with an almost uncontrollable impulse to jump out of the car and run. Barney was startled and tried to find out what was wrong. Betty was nearing a state of panic. Without asking any more questions, Barney speeded up as fast as was practicable with people partially blocking the road, and Betty recovered her equilibrium. What disturbed her most was that she was not at all inclined to be this emotional. She had never before or since experienced such a sensation. The impact of the unexplainable incident stayed with them for many days afterward, as well as the effect of the nightmares on Betty, that still persisted. Realizing that Barney was attempting to put the UFO event out of his mind, Betty refrained from discussing the nightmares with him. But she began telling a few close friends, one of whom was a fellow social worker, who urged her to write down her dreams. Feeling that this might relieve her conscious preoccupation with them, she sat down at her typewriter and wrote. Her dreams were unusual in subject matter and detail. They revealed that she encountered a strange roadblock on a lonely New Hampshire road as a group of men approached the car. The men were dressed alike. As soon as they reached the car, she slipped into unconsciousness. She awoke to find herself and Barney being taken aboard a wholly strange craft, where she was given a complete physical examination by intelligent, humanoid beings. Barney was taken off down a corridor, curving to the contour of the ship, for apparently the same reason. They were assured, in the dream, that no harm would come to them and that they would be released without any conscious memory of the strange happening. Betty's written paper on the dreams was in complete detail, with full descriptions of the craft, the examination, and the humanoid beings. It was to play a large part in what happened 2 years later, a part she could not anticipate now. In her bewilderment over the incident she and Barney had so recently experienced. 32, CHAPTER 3. On October 19, 1961, Walter Webb, lecturer on the staff of the Hayden Planetarium in Boston, opened his mail to read a letter from Richard Hall, then secretary and now assistant director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena in Washington. As a scientific advisor to NICAP, Walter Webb occasionally investigated the more serious and puzzling UFO reports in the New England area, drafting a detailed document for Washington when the merits of the case warranted it. Hall's letter included a copy of the letter Betty Hill had written to Major Kehoe and suggested to Webb that it might be worthwhile to drive the 80 miles north of Boston to Portsmouth to investigate the case. Webb, who had joined the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, shortly after his graduation from college in 1956, had been interested in unidentified flying objects since 1951, when, as a counselor at a Boys Camp in Michigan, H.E. had made a sighting while training campers in the use of a telescope. Although his work with the Smithsonian Satellite Tracking Program required months of photographing satellites against a star background from a volcanic mountain in Hawaii during the International Geophysical Year, he had not personally observed any further UFOs since his experience at the boys' camp. His own sighting was totally convincing to him that such objects did exist, but his intense interest in the subject did not bloom fully until the summer of 1952. When a now famous group of sightings was made over Washington, recorded on several radar screens, and, 33, confirmed by competent visual observers both in the air and on the ground. Many details on this event were quickly hushed by the Air Force, and further intelligent study of the phenomenon was rendered impossible. The sighting Webb had made with his nature studies students at camp followed a pattern reported many times to NICAP. It was a clear summer night, and the three members of the group spotted a red-orange object traveling from east to west over the southern hills beyond Big Silver Lake in Michigan. At first they suspected that it might have been an ordinary aircraft, but its movements shattered all conventional aerodynamic patterns. The object moved in a strange, undulating manner, creating a perfect sine wave course over the hills in the distance, a course in which the up and down dips described a smooth, bell-shaped pattern along the tops of the hills. Webb's first reaction to Richard Hall's letter was reluctance. It was plain that this case involved a report of the movement of beings on the craft, and Webb was skeptical of this type of sighting. There had been in the past a rash of this sort of thing from highly irresponsible people, none of whom had provided any kind of rational documentation, and who insisted on talking about such incidents in the most exaggerated terms. Webb was determined not to become associated / with any such irresponsible case. He drove up to Portsmouth on October 2, 1961, with his skeptical attitude unchanged. In his mind were thoughts of the sensational nature of the claim, the possibility that the Hales might be seeking publicity, perpetrating a hoax, or suffering from a mental aberration. On the other hand, Webb felt that Betty Hill's letter was extremely literate, an honest and straightforward account of a frightening experience which had happened to two people. He would reserve judgment until after his interview, which, he resolved, would be thorough and painstaking, with special attention to finding flaws in the story. As an interviewer with a scientific background, he was certain he could create if he could. He arrived at the Hillales house at about noon. Bianney was relieved to lend an intelligent man, who would not ridicule or pooh-pooh the experience, showing a demonstrable interest in the event. Bianney was at the point where he detested the term lying saucer, although Webb's reference to UFOs was palatable to him. Further, he hoped that he could learn a slip up somewhere if their Hill's story was spurious, and he would not hesitate to crack the story. 31. More about the subject from Webb, to give some kind of answer to the mystery which still burned in him underneath the surface. To Betty, Webb appeared to be extremely professional, and obviously was skilled and experienced in interviewing people. The interview began shortly after noon, and continued with little interruption until late that evening. "I was so amazed, impressed by both the Hills and their account," Walter Webb later said, "that we skipped lunch and went right through the afternoon and early evening. During that time, I cross-examined them together, separately, together, re-questioned them again and again. I tried to make them slip up somewhere, and I couldn't, I simply couldn't. Theirs was an ironclad story. They seemed to me to be a sincere, honest couple driving home from vacation, late at night on a lonely road, when suddenly something completely unknown and undefinable descended on them. Something entirely foreign or alien to their existence." During the interview, the Hills gave Webb their sketches, drawn independently, yet comparing so identically. As the interview drew toward a close, Bianney found himself almost reliving the incident. He could see himself standing in the road confronted by the enormous object. "It was a long grilling," Bianney describes the Webb interview. "He began asking us questions, going over in detail all the experiences. First, we bade to recite the story. Then he would have us go back and regress to different periods of the experience, so that all the details would come out. Then, I would come to this curtain the moment I put the field glasses on the vehicle and saw this figure close up. And here, as with every other time I've tried to think it through, could never get past this curtain in my memory. I could go no further, but I had the most eerie, chilling feeling, like watching a late show by myself at night. I get chills as the ghost walks around the old haunted house. And I continually got chills when I got to that point of thought, whether it was during the Webb interview or at other times. I would get chills, I would shudder, and I would look briefly around in the room, though I was safely in the comfort of my own home." Walter Webb had a map with him, and he carefully used it to fill in a complete timetable of the Hills' journey. For some reason, although the Hills explained in detail about the shiny spots on the car, they forgot to show them to him, and Webb forgot to ask to examine them. None of the three can explain this oversight, although Webb said, "I have tried to recall whether I saw those silvery spots they claim to have seen on the car immediately following the sighting. To this day, I can't. I am sure I did. 35. Not go out and look at the car. I knew of the spots. This is just poor reporting on my part. Poor investigation. Maybe I just didn't think there was anything to these spots. In fact, in my initial report on the case, I reduced the spots and the beeping noises to a very low value. I mentioned them in an embarrassed way, "Well, here it is, but what is it?" And I went on from there. I don't recall ever checking. If I recall it, Barney said, there was so much detail we got into the position of the moon when we saw it, identification of the stars and weather conditions, things like that, that it slipped our minds to get Webb to check the spots. At the close of the session, Webb suggested to the Hills that they drive back over the trip, trying to pin down the exact spots where varied events happened, the first notice of the object, the frequent short stops between Lancaster and Indian Head, and the exact spot near the flume and Indian Head where the closest encounter took place. The Hills agreed, and Barney gave up most of his reluctance to review the case, as a result of Walter Webb's intensive cross-examination. Driving back to Boston, Webb mentally reviewed the case. He was extremely impressed by it. His doubts about a hoax, about the Hills' competence, about an aberration, were dispelled. I had read of such cases before, Webb said later, but this is the first time I had come in contact with apparently reliable witnesses who claimed to have seen UFO occupants. Of course, we have to be very careful about such cases. Very careful. I was impressed that the Hills underplayed the dramatic aspects of the case. They were not trying to sensationalize. They did not seek publicity. They wanted me to keep this just to myself, confidential, with NICAP. Barney's complete resistance to the idea of UFOs was most convincing. There were two different personalities here, in a way, Barney the more careful, scientific, accurate person, and Betty, the talker. But at the same time, she didn't overdo it, either. 5 days later, Webb prepared his report for NICAP in Washington, reviewing the incident in the minutest detail, including compass directions, position of the moon and planets, weather, and detailed description of the object, including the sketches the Hills had given him. He concluded his lengthy report, "It is the opinion of this investigator, after questioning these people for over 6 hours and studying their reactions and personalities during that time, that they were telling their 36 truth, and the incident occurred exactly as reported except for some minor uncertainties and technicalities that must be tolerated in any such observation where human judgment is involved, that is, exact time and length of visibility, apparent sizes of object and occupants, distance and height of object, etc. Although their occupations do not especially qualify the witnesses as trained scientific observers, I was impressed by their intelligence, apparent honesty, and obvious desire to get at the facts and to underplay the more sensational aspects of the sighting." Mr. Hill had been a complete UFO skeptic before the sighting. In fact, the experience so jolted his reason and sensibilities that his mind evidently could not make the adjustment. In his conversation with me, and with his wife since the sighting, a mental block occurred when he mentioned the leader peering out the window at him. Mr. Hill believes he saw something he doesn't want to remember. He claimed he was not close enough to see any facial characteristics on the figures, although at another time he referred to one of them looking over his shoulder and grinning, and to the leader's exposed sunless face. However, it is my view that the observer's blackout is not of any great significance. Later this was to be seriously challenged. I think the whole experience was so improbable and fantastic to witness, along with the very real fear of being captured adding to imagined fears, that his mind finally refused to believe what his eyes were perceiving, and a mental block resulted. Needless to say, neither Mr. Hill nor his wife are UFO doubters any longer. Both are now quite interested in the UFO subject and wish to know more about it and read as much as they can. Near the conclusion of the interview, I was asked many questions concerning the possible nature and origin of such objects. It will be noted that there were no electromagnetic disturbances, such as engine and headlight failure, mentioned in other close-range, 2i, UFO observations. However, the code-like beeping sounds on the rear of the car, a 19572 door hardtop, are an unexplained feature of the case. Neither did the witnesses notice any physiological effects, warmth, bumps, shock, or paralysis. The dog did not appear to be alarmed at any time during the whole sighting. The Hills at this point had forgotten to tell Webb about several instances of Dilsey's odd behavior. There were no other aircraft in the sky. Just for the record, not that there is any connection at all. The Hills sighting took place a day before Hurricane Nestor's rains and winds hit New England. The Hills live in Portsmouth, N.H. Barney, 39, is a clerk at A, 37, Boston, Mass., Post Office, South Station, and Beatty, 41, is a child welfare worker employed at Portsmouth by the New Hampshire Department of Public Welfare. New Hampshire has furnished quite a number of UFO reports in recent years. For example, in 1960 NICAP recorded 7 sightings, 6 of them in the White Mountains area, especially around Plymouth. Of particular interest were the red cigar-shaped objects seen during April twice from Plymouth, on the 15th and 25th, and once from West Thornton, on the 28th. See NICAP Special Bulletin, May 1, 1960. P. 4. Another cigar was observed in the same area, near Rumney, on August 24. See NICAP report form on case. About 8 years ago, Mrs. Hill's sister, Janet, was driving from Kingston, N.H., to Haverhill, Mass., on Route 125 and saw near Plaistow, N.H., a large glowing object in the sky with smaller objects flying around it. She ran to a house and got others to look at the strange apparition. They all saw the smaller objects fly into the larger one, which then took off. /S/W.N. Webb, the 26th of October 1961, as a scientific advisor at NICAP, Webb had an extensive knowledge of the files of the organization and, of course, immediate access to them. Under the direction of Major Kehoe, a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and former Marine Corps pilot, the organization constantly emphasizes that it avoids any preposterous claims regarding UFOs and instructs its area representatives to disprove cases before accepting the sighting as related. Wherever possible, NICAP concentrates only on those sightings by pilots, radarmen, police, engineers, technicians, and responsible and competent citizens. Major Kehoe's battle with the Air Force has been going on for over a decade. In the course of its investigations, NICAP receives over 40,000 letters a year, many of which are fresh reports of new sightings that are constantly cropping up in this country and throughout the world. Beginning in the spring of 1965, 4 years after the Hills encounter, reports of low JCVC Allen and car landing UFO sightings increased so that the organization was overwhelmed with documentation on the phenomenon. The Oklahoma, Texas and New Mexico sightings during August of .18-1965 involved nearly 40 members of the Oklahoma State Highway Patrol, with its teletypes clogged for 3 nights with UFO reports made by its officers and hundreds of reliable layman sightings corroborated by radar fixes from the Carswell and Tinker Air Force bases. In Exeter, New Hampshire, 2 seasoned policemen encountered an enormous UFO at low level, so low that one of the officers dropped to the ground and drew his gun. During the fall and winter of 1965-66, hundreds of other people in the area reported similar experiences documented by taped interviews and cross-examinations, resulting in overwhelming evidence for the existence of the objects. The Michigan sightings in March of 1966, involving policemen and hundreds of reliable witnesses, brought the subject to a head, including a demand by Republican House leader Gerald Ford for a full-scale congressional investigation. In announcing his findings as special consultant to the Air Force, Dr. J. Allen Hayek, chairman of the Department of Astronomy at Northwestern University and director of the Dearborn Observatory, was widely misquoted by the press regarding his statement that the sightings might be attributed to a spontaneous combustion of methane or marsh gas. What Dr. Hayek did say was that 2 of the sightings might be attributed to this phenomenon, but that these 2 cases by no means explained the hundreds of unidentified sightings by reliable people that were continuing to be reported throughout the world. In his press release, he urged that a scientific panel be set up to study the subject in depth, a statement that was largely ignored by the press. Back in 1961, when Walter Webb was trying to fit the pieces of their Hill case together, none of this recent and startling evidence was available.